And the bed wasn't an actual bed. It was the day bed we used to have in the hallway alcove of our old apartment. I had been the one to suggest moving it into the room we jokingly called his suite at the office. With no windows, the room was perfect for a quick catnap when Jason's early bird grind caught up to him in the afternoon. I tried calling Jason's cell phone, but it went straight to voicemail. Jason, call me as soon as you get this. I sent a text with the same message. I scrolled down the page on my iPad to see the Facebook comments accompanying the post article. It was going viral. I knew this good guy's shtick was an act. The police are about to arrest? Is he still teaching undergrads? WTF! I know a girl at school who interns with him. She's the only female in the program, and it has to be her. Name is Rachel Sutton. She's hot. Several comments followed that one, scolding the author for doxing the woman who was single-handedly ruining my husband's reputation. Apparently, it was okay for Jason to be named, but her privacy was to be protected. I made a mental note of her name and continued skimming the comments. What kind of professor meets with a student alone in a bedroom? OMG, his son goes to my daughter's school. He always seems so nice. I'm crushed. The author of that last comment was a woman named Jane Reese. I clicked on her profile picture and recognized the teenage girl next to her from Spencer's choir performances. According to Facebook, Jane and I were friends, and she was the one who was crushed. I clicked the unfriend button. Spencer. Jesus, Spencer. I had protected him from so much, but I was powerless to shelter him from this. I Googled my name and Spencer's, using both Powell and Mullen, searching for any mentions within the last 24 hours. No one had dragged us into the story, not yet, anyway. But if some random internet user had already posted the name of Rachel Sutton, how long would it be before people who thought they knew something about me jumped into the fray? Spencer had a pillow pulled over his head to block the light seeping around the window shade. He let out a moan when I sat at the foot of his bed. My son had a way of treating each morning as a theater audition. Do I need to remind you that little girls in other parts of the world have literally died trying to get an education? Time for school, mister. He squinted up at me from beneath his shaggy hair. Normal moms say get the fuck up before I kill you. This is my precocious son's idea of normal. I prefer guilt trips to death threats. Get up. But we need to talk for a second. Some kids at the school might be talking about Dad. Spencer had started calling Jason Dad after our first anniversary. We never asked why. We were just grateful. Loretta's mom has an Academy Award, and Henry's dad is literally like a musical genius. Trust me, no one talks about Dad. Ah, the joys of a private school in Manhattan. There's a story going around the internet. Someone accused him of something. It'll get cleared up, but I need you to try to block it all out today at school. What do you mean he was accused? There was no way I could keep the details from my son, not with a 24/7 media cycle. It's a student from the university. College students can overreact, Spencer. I started babbling from there. I told him that sometimes extremely troubled students found their way into the university. That his father had done nothing but try to help her by supervising an internship. The teachers have conflicts with students all the time, but Dad had the additional complication of being a public person. It was possible the student was looking for attention at his expense. So what are people going to say? I searched his pale brown eyes, which peered out beneath wisps of hair that should have been cut 2 weeks ago. My son was too old to be treated like a child, but he was young compared to his peers. His friend Henry, for example, son of the musical genius, had two nannies, a driver, and a bodyguard at his disposal, and saw his parents twice a month. These kids would pull no punches. That a student accused your father of inappropriate behavior. What? Like, sex? I said I didn't know, exactly. That it was a misunderstanding. That I only told him in case someone mentioned it at school. And this is, like, online? He started to get up. Probably heading for the phone, I made him dock downstairs in the kitchen. One of the phone-related mom rules, along with divulging his passcode, asking permission before sharing photographs of others, and, most controversially, all phones in airplane mode while the car is moving. I tried not to think about the other parents whispering in their kitchens right now about my husband. Or the NYU students texting links to one another during class, or the people I used to know on the East End. Gloating that my perfect life in the city hadn't worked out quite so well, after all. This young woman is obviously troubled, Spencer, deeply. And your father's been trying to help her, okay? I was hinting at facts I knew nothing about, but needed to offer some kind of explanation for what was happening. Troubled girl gets fixated on successful mentors seemed, sadly, to work. Mom, I can't go to school. You have to let me stay home. I walked to the bathroom in the hallway and turned on the water in the shower. It took forever to heat. You can't stay home, or people might assume he's guilty. He's your father, Spencer, and you're not a child anymore. We have to protect our family. 7. While Spencer was in the shower, I tried Jason again. I hung up when I heard the familiar, "You've reached Jason Powell." I'd already left 2 voicemails and 3 text messages. I flipped on the small television hanging beneath our kitchen counter, keeping the volume low to make sure I'd hear Spencer on the stairs in time to turn it off. I flipped to New Day. Jason initially became a semi-regular on the show due to our friendship with one of the hosts, Susanna Coleman. Now that Jason's commentary was widely sought after, he still appeared about once a month, primarily out of loyalty. Susanna and her co-host Eric were in the studio's kitchen, flanking a chef I recognized from one of those cable cooking shows. The chef was saying, "See, perfect al dente," while Susanna and Eric attempted to sample the supposedly perfect spaghetti strands with grace. Susanna was nodding in agreement until her mouth was free to speak. "You're my hero. I always overcook my pasta." Had Jason already been on the air this morning? What was he supposed to talk about today? He had brought it up the night before while I was trying to read Spencer's paper about James Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain. My son was only in the 7th grade, but some of his homework was already more sophisticated than anything I had ever done in school. I had stopped reading to look up the word circumlocution on my phone when Jason mentioned his plans for the TV segment. Oh, now I remembered. 7 retailers who were changing the world in small ways. It didn't take an economist, let alone one with Jason's credentials, to hype footwear and blankets, but these were the compromises he made for the sake of expanding his platform. Had he really gone on air and talked about guilt-free splurges without acknowledging the claim against him? No way. The Twitter sphere would have been merciless. These days, the public thinks they're owed an immediate explanation. I reached for my phone and Googled Jason Powell New Day, then narrowed the search for posts within the last hour. I found the answer to my question on a website that covered celebrities from a feminist perspective. 7 minutes into New Day's opening, co-host Eric Jordan abruptly interrupted one of Susanna Coleman's stories about her beloved dog. "I'm sorry, Susanna, but no one wants to hear about Franny. Let's talk about the elephant in the room." He identified the elephant as the New York Post's report that morning that a college intern had accused Dr. Jason Powell, our own Dr. Jason, of inappropriate conduct. The irony of a man interrupting a woman to insist that she discuss allegations of sexual misconduct did not seem to be missed by Coleman. "You're telling me what I can and can't talk about right now." Jordan proceeded to read what appeared to be a prepared statement. "As journalists, we know that every individual is presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law. But as a television program, New Day is also aware that the off-screen actions of on-air personalities can be distracting from quality content. As such, the segment we announced yesterday featuring Dr. Jason Powell for today has been canceled." The program went to commercial and proceeded as business as usual from there. In other words, everyone's presumed innocent unless we think it will hurt our ratings. Hearing Spencer's heavy steps on the staircase, I clicked off the television and placed my phone on the counter, screen down. "Chocolate chip pancakes," he said dryly as I placed 3 perfect round discs onto a plate. "I thought you said I shouldn't eat like a little kid anymore." I hated the voice my son used when he impersonated me, so pinched and harpy. I let it slide for that day and didn't mention the context for that particular lecture, his picking at his dinner the night before, only to order pizza 2 hours later. I shrugged and handed him the plate and a bottle of syrup. Pancakes were not part of the usual rotation of weekday breakfasts. "If some skank accuses Dad of murder, will I get a car?" "Don't use words like that," I said, pointing a stern finger, though I was smiling as I said it. Finding humor was my son's way of dealing with the most unhumorous situations, and he knew how that kind of talk got under my skin. "Besides, I'm in denial that you'll ever be old enough to drive." He didn't complain when I followed him out the front door after breakfast. At his request, I had stopped walking him to school this year, but I still found days when I was going that direction anyway. Jason had been adamant about paying for Spencer to go to a good school. I thought the spring school had been perfectly good. It was the same grade school I attended. It was the grade school that most kids in East Hampton attended, not the uber-rich sections of East Hampton, but the way north of the highway area where the normal people lived. People like my family. People like Spencer and me before I met Jason. Manhattan was different, Jason explained. We couldn't drop Spencer into any random school. Parents who had to rely on public education chose their zip codes based on the quality of grade schools, and kids had to compete from there for spots in the best high schools. Families who could afford to opted for private schools, hiring consultants to assemble application packages and cozying up to potential references. The whole process sounded nauseating, but Jason knew more about education than I ever would, so I toured the go-to private schools. Friends Seminary had been the only one where I could picture Spencer being comfortable. Yes, there were children of rock stars and Oscar winners, but there were regular kids, too, and it was Quaker. That had to mean that people were good, right? I expected Jason to balk at the price tag, but the bigger issue was the school's 16th Street address. The trip from his apartment on the Upper West Side to the village was only 3 miles, but it was a long haul, given Manhattan traffic at peak hours. Jason decided we would move downtown. But what about the park? He had opted for the apartment on 74th Street for its access to Central Park, where he could enjoy open space and maintain his 25-mile-a-week running regimen. I'll be the weirdo who does 20 laps around Washington Square. Besides, it's walking distance to the university. I should have moved a long time ago. We could barely afford the rent on a 2-bedroom on Waverly when we first made the move to the village. Now, thanks to Jason's extra income, we owned our home on 12th Street, an actual carriage house complete with a street-level parking garage, less than a 10-minute walk from Friends. I could feel Spencer's pace slow as we neared the school. As usual, his eyes were glued to his phone. Catching Pokemons? So, 2 years ago, Mom. And you know what I'm looking at. It's gonna be okay, Spencer. You know your dad wouldn't do something like that, right? Well, yeah, but that doesn't matter. Police set people up all the time. People go to prison for, like, their whole lives, and then it comes out they were innocent the whole time. There's a place called the Innocence Project. Haven't you heard of it? My son is starting to figure out that I'm not as educated as the other adults in his life. I hate the feeling of disappointing him. Yes, I've heard of it, but that's irrelevant. Your father's not going to prison. It's all a misunderstanding. Absolutely nothing happened. Once again, I tried to sound like I knew more than I actually did. Your dad's going to be fine. Yeah, I know, he said. We're rich. I hate that my son knows so much already about the world. Besides, this isn't nearly as bad as what some other kids went through. Seth's dad's been in rehab for basically all of middle school, and Karen's older sister made a sex tape with Little Pony. My Little Pony? No, Mom. Little Pony. Jeez, he's a rapper. Not my fault his name's stupid. We were at the corner before the school entrance, the farthest he'd let me walk with him these days. He did allow me to give him a big hug. When I opened my eyes, I saw Jane Reese standing next to a black Escalade in the middle of the block, watching us. She quickly turned away. I wondered if she had noticed yet that I had unfriended her. Thank you, Spencer. You're a good kid. Remember, when they go low, we go high. I gave him a quick fist tap for good measure. Are you gonna be okay? I mean, what if people find out about, you know, us? I don't really care, but I felt a catch in my throat. My son, facing school to pretend he wasn't scared that his entire world was falling apart, was worried about me. The police will have this cleared up in no time. It's all gonna be fine. I looked away so he couldn't see the uncertainty in my eyes. Even he had no idea how much I distrusted the police or my reasons. I was almost home when my cell phone rang. My screen read AMC, the American Media Center, the network that runs New Day. Maybe Jason was calling from the green room. Jason? It was about time. No, it's me. Susanna was whispering. I'm calling from the set during your commercial break. Are you okay? No, I'm not okay. I didn't know anything about this. I found out online. The show felt the need to read a statement? Based on the word of some... The word skank came to mind, planted in my frontal lobe by Spencer minutes ago. Student? Don't get me started. That was obviously the studio going to Eric behind my back. They probably knew I would have thrown down to defend him. Television personalities have come and gone during Susanna's tenure at New Day, and few women sustain careers into their 40s, but Susanna was practically an institution at AMC. She briefly served as lead anchor for the evening news several years ago, but decided she enjoyed the banter of entertainment programming instead. She was approaching 60 years old and was still beloved. On the other hand, no woman was immune from reality. The network had the decency to present Susanna and Eric as equal co-hosts, but Susanna happened to know that Eric was 12 years younger, earned twice as much, and was treated as the heir apparent to the network brand. I spent the whole morning pretending that everything was normal for Spencer's sake, but now that I was alone, listening to my friend's panicked whisper, my whole body began to shake. "Did you see Jason this morning?" I asked. "He's not returning my calls." For a millisecond, I popped into the green room to say hey, but couldn't stick around. He seemed totally normal. Then I heard some crew members yentying it up outside my dressing room. That's how I found out about the Post article, but I literally had no time before going on air. The next thing I know, Eric's throwing him under the bus on live television. Is it possible Jason didn't see the news before he got to the studio? It was more than possible. Jason's morning routine was a paragon of efficiency. No time for newspaper or web browsing. I don't know, and I have no idea where he is right now. I'm trying not to completely lose it. I could hear someone speaking urgently in the background. Shoot, I gotta go, but I'll call you when I'm off air. I took a cue from my son and kept myself from crying by searching for something funny to say. By the way, you told that chef you always overcook your pasta? Hypothetically, in my imagination. Ciao. I happen to know that Susanna never cooked anything. That's how we first became friends, and it's how I met Jason. 8. Full-time work on the East End is hard to find, to the extent that farming and fishing have been replaced by the construction of new mega-homes. It's still work I don't know how to do. The retail shops and restaurants are packed in the summer, but only hire part-time, and often close altogether in the off-season. I was looking for a job at the age of 19 with nothing to boast but a recently obtained GED, a high school equivalence degree in name, but apparently not in perception. And it didn't help that my reason for not finishing regular school was the 3 years I had spent away from the East End. When I finally came home, I heard the not-so-quiet whispers about the hell I'd put my parents through. I was finally hired at Blue Heron Farms, a third-generation family business where the men fish and farm and the women cook and sell the food. What started as a side-of-the-road farm stand had grown into a posh summer market. Before the term farm-to-table became fashionable, Blue Heron had been providing delicious, fresh food to Hampton's visitors eager to avoid cooking. I started at the cash register. After suggesting a few recipes I'd played around with in my parents' kitchen, I was added to the cooking staff. It was my idea to launch a side business of setting up homes for weekenders. My mom would clean the house, I'd make sure that it was freshly stocked with food and drinks. To find customers, I left flyers on the windshields of the fanciest cars at Main Beach. Susanna was my first regular. By the middle of the summer, she was so happy with the food that I was preparing that she gave me a shot at catering a small cocktail party. I picked up more clients from there, and somewhere along the way, Susanna and I became something like caretakers for each other. I looked after her home, she looked out for me. She even offered the use of her guest cottage for the off-season. Mom and Dad made it clear they didn't want me to move. At first, I wondered if they had their own motives. It was only natural they wanted to keep Spencer and me safe under their wing. And Dad was having what we thought were back problems, making it hard for him to work. We'd only find out later, after he died of a stroke, that the problem wasn't his back at all. It was clogged arteries in his legs. But at the time, my extra income was helping to cover expenses. In the end, Mom talked me out of it, saying it would make me too dependent on Susanna. You can't have your son growing up in the backyard of a stranger's house like Dobby the house elf. She had a point. I was used to guests hitting on me during catering gigs. I was in my early 20s, wore my dark blonde hair and long, beachy waves, and had the perfect tan for those little black cocktail dresses that the Hampton set prefers for their party staff. When they asked me what I was doing when I got off work, my go-to response was going home to my son. Nothing like a kid to get rid of a man looking to hook up. But Jason was different. It was Susanna's Memorial Day party, her biggest bash of the year. Two of my staff, a barback and a kitchen helper, had no-showed, one of the risks of hiring summer Hamptonites as supplemental workers. Their first priority was to party, and it was the kickoff weekend of the season. The icing on the cake was the delivery guy from the party rental company, a local who didn't like me for acting uppity since I came home. When he saw that I was the one running the fancy party, he decided to dump all the chairs and tables in the driveway, foregoing the usual custom of moving and assembling them for a tip. I did the work myself, instead of telling Susanna that not everyone in town liked me as much as she did. I was scrambling to make sure I didn't let her down, but keeping up proved less impossible than I had feared. I'd turn around, and the platter of shrimp cocktail that was running low would suddenly be replenished. The stack of tasting plates accumulating next to the bar would be cleared. I had assumed that one of the two girls I had hired to pass trays for the party had been pitching in, until I walked into the kitchen to find a man reaching into the refrigerator for a plate of deviled eggs topped with caviar. He looked surprised to see me when he turned around.
Busted.
His grin suggested a combination of pride and guilt. I was about to get those. Sorry. When you work summers in the Hamptons, you get used to apologizing for things you have no reason to be sorry for.
For what? So far, you're the best thing about this party.
I thought it was the beginning of yet another pass until he pulled the plastic wrap from the plate and popped an egg in his mouth, one full bite.
This food is heaven, he said once his mouth was clear. And these people are assholes.
And yet you're here.
True.
The grin again.
So everyone who's not in the kitchen is an asshole, except Susanna. Her I love. I'll be a good boy and won't tell her I hate these people. Well, except for the nice woman who's working her butt off to feed all of us.
He pulled this special deviled egg tray from a stack of platters on the kitchen island.
I assume these go here?
Absolutely nothing else could possibly go there. We began moving the eggs over, two at a time, in silence. When we were finished, he grabbed the tray and left, giving me a little wink as he backed through the swinging kitchen door.
No one has spotted me yet. I feel like a ninja.
When the party died down, he reappeared in the kitchen as I was packing up the leftovers for Susanna's freezer. He even helped me carry my equipment out to the pickup truck I had parked behind Susanna's guest house.
Cool ride, he said.
I didn't tell him that I had borrowed it from a man named Matt Miller, or that Matt and I were kind of a thing. When the work was done, he closed the truck door for me, and that was almost it. I had backed out of Susanna's driveway and was halfway down the block when I saw him in my rearview mirror, walking toward one of the last cars parked on the street, lighting a cigarette. I reversed back and rolled down the passenger window. I assumed you were one of Susanna's weekend guests.
Nope, just stayed late.
He was in the driver's seat and about to shut the door when I said, I'm Angela, by the way.
I'm Jason. Thanks for the nice party.
I broke down and asked Susanna for his last name 2 days later. She told me he was an economics professor at NYU. He's single, you know. I called him last year for background on a story we did about global trade, but then I happened to mention my house out here. He was looking for a rental. Anyway, he's terrific. Want me to matchmake? I didn't want to put Susanna in the position of suggesting that her college professor friend date a mom with a GED, so I made her promise not to say anything. I was curious, is all. By the time Jason called me a week later, he was all I could think about. To this day, both he and Susanna swear that she never meddled. 9. When I got back from walking Spencer to school, I called out Jason's name, but the house was silent. I sat on the living room sofa and flipped open my laptop. If you search online for Jason Powell, wife, you find out that her name is Angela Powell. You'll find exactly one photograph of us together at a fundraiser for a mayoral candidate. Jason posts no pictures of me or Spencer on social media, and my Facebook page is under the name of Angela Spencer and used only to be in touch with the other moms at the school. If you search for Angela Mullen, you'll learn she was credited as a sought-after caterer in a few articles about summer life on the East End, but no mentions of her for the last 6 years. If you dig hard, you might find some archived news articles, nothing national, only from the East Hampton Star and Newsday on Long Island, right around the time Google became a verb, referring to a missing girl by that name. The police said there were no signs of foul play, and unnamed sources speculated the girl had left on her own. But her mother, Virginia Mullen, doggedly blanketed Suffolk County with flyers and swore she would never stop searching for her daughter. But, at least with my online skills, you wouldn't know for certain that the girl and the caterer were one and the same, or that Angela Powell used to be both of those girls, or where Angela Mullen was while she was missing, let alone why she might actually be of interest. How long could Jason's scandal make the rounds before someone started to wonder why his wife kept such a low profile? I tried Jason's cell once again. It was still off. Is he on the subway? Has he been arrested? Is he
with someone? Another woman, maybe? My imagination ran through every scenario. I wasn't going to be able to do anything else until I heard from him. When my phone finally rang, I swiped right to accept the call without reading the screen. Jason?
It's Colin. I've been trying to reach him, too.
Do you know about these reports I'm seeing? Does he need a defense lawyer? I've got some names for him.
In addition to being Jason's closest friend, Colin Harris is also an attorney and the kind of person who likes to fix problems. 5 years ago, when I had my medical issues, he bombarded me with recommendations for specialists who could help. He was not going to rest until my troubles were solved. That's what Colin is like. He's not answering his phone, I said. I mean, Colin, if Jason's not in jail, I might be, for killing him.
Did he know this complaint was coming?
I have no idea. I mean, he told me that a female intern complained he said something sexist. He sounded annoyed by the whole situation, but he didn't mention the police. He left this morning for a segment he was supposed to do on New Day. They canceled it, as if Jason was Ted Bundy or something. He didn't call you?
No,
Colin confirmed. I tried to find comfort in that fact. Colin was a well-connected insurance defense lawyer at a big law firm that represented big corporations. If Jason thought he was in legal trouble, surely he would have called Colin. Now that I was on the phone with another person, I felt tawdry for scanning Rachel Sutton's Facebook page. She probably had no idea that one of her classmates had outed her name in an online comment and that others were now repeating it on various less-than-reputable websites. Graduated with honors from Rice University in Houston, head of the Environmental Society. Volunteer for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals while pursuing her graduate degree in economics at NYU. There was a photograph posted a week ago of two hands entwined on a tabletop. The female hand bore a solitaire diamond ring. The caption read, "I said yes." 72 comments of congratulations followed for Rachel and the groom-to-be, who was apparently named Michael Logan. Colin was asking if I had tried calling both of Jason's offices at the university and at FSS. He didn't answer, I said, scrolling down to scan more photographs of Rachel. She had dark brown hair, pale skin, and pretty almond-shaped eyes. She looked like she could be mixed race. She looked nothing like me.
"Did you call Zach?" Colin asked.
I realized that Colin knew Jason's professional friends better than I did, the consequence of my avoiding his work-related shindigs, where I inevitably felt out of my element. I have no interest in socializing with grown adults who always seem to launch a first conversation with, "And where did you go to school, Angela?" When I told him that I hadn't reached out to Jason's protege, Colin said he would call Zach and let me know if he heard anything. Before he hung up, he told me to let Jason know that he had the name of a hardcore crim shark ready to go. He also promised that everything would be all right. I found myself staring at a photograph of Rachel with two other gorgeous 20-somethings, one male, one female. According to the check-in, the photograph was taken at some place called Le Bain, apparently a rooftop bar at the Standard Hotel. Swanky. I clicked on the name of the male friend tagged in the picture. Wilson Stewart. He had perfect white teeth and floppy, sandy brown hair. He was a frequent poster, politics, food reviews, lots of photographs. At this point, I was hitting my laptop's touchpad at random to keep my mind occupied. I was reading about the online persona created by this stranger, Rachel's young, good-looking friend, Wilson Stewart, when my cell phone rang again. The screen told me it was Jason. "Where are you?"
"At school." "Shit, you heard already, didn't you?"
"It's all over the news," I said. "Online, at least. Aunt Susanna called. So did Colin. He has a lawyer he wants you to contact. What the hell is going on, Jason? Rachel's claiming you assaulted her? You told me it was an offhand comment."
"It's complicated, okay? I didn't think it would come to this."
When he mentioned it at dinner right after it happened, he'd sounded amused by it. Now it was complicated. I heard him sigh on the other end of the line.
"A cop called, a woman, while I was in Philly. I told her I wasn't talking without a lawyer. I was ready to call Colin if she pressed it, but she didn't. I assumed she was dotting her I's because Rachel blew it out of proportion. Now this."
I told him again I'd been trying to call him all morning. "Where have you been?"
"The dean's office. His secretary was dialing my cell before I even left the television studio. I felt like a child being hauled into the damn principal's office. He said the university is initiating its own investigation. If they try to use this to fuck with me, it could derail everything. I knew he didn't literally mean everything. He would still have me and Spencer, and he'd told me how hard it was to revoke a professor's tenure. Jason was referring to everything else that was important to him right now. His newfound role as a public intellectual, his plans for the future. His voice trailed off. I had seen my husband go from the dean's beloved academic wunderkind to an outsider in a handful of years. After the Wall Street Journal reported that Jason got a 7-figure deal for his book, his colleagues accused him of being a sellout. They liked him better when he published heavily footnoted articles that no one read. Jason, are you sure there isn't something else I should know? I shut my eyes, afraid of the answer. Maybe there was a flirtation, a moment between an admiring young student and her attractive professor. I pictured all the girls daydreaming about Professor Harrison Ford and Raiders of the Lost Ark. Love you, etched on a set of eyelids. I fell for Jason at about the same age. Why wouldn't they? He answered immediately.
I swear on my mother's grave, Angela, nothing happened. It was, oh, damn it, when she walked into my office, I was changing clothes. She must have thought.
I held my free hand in my face. Jesus, Jason.
What? I ran at lunch and had taken a shower. It's not like I was naked. I was tucking in my shirt, I think. I was almost done when she walked in, or I would have told her to come back later. This girl's crazy. Yeah, damn it, I want a fucking cigarette.
Don't even. When Jason asked Spencer what he wanted for his 13th birthday, Spencer had asked his father to quit smoking. I want you to live forever, Dad. Jason resisted at first, joking that he liked the look on strangers' faces when they saw him light up after a long run. But he finally quit on New Year's, successfully substituting gum for the cigarettes he'd taken up while finishing his PhD dissertation. I didn't realize I was still scrolling through Wilson Stewart's Facebook page until I stopped suddenly on a photograph. He was drinking from a highball glass, something dark, maybe scotch. His eyes were glazed, trying to focus on the screen for the selfie he was taking. A thin arm was draped around his waist from behind. A head of dark, shiny hair was visible over his shoulder. Pale skin pressed against his neck as two lips found the lobe of his ear. No ring. Not yet. It was Rachel Sutton. I clicked about on this friend of Rachel's profile page. He was also a graduate student at NYU. Current work? Fair share strategies. Jason, do you know someone named Wilson Stewart?
He's one of the interns. Why?
I rushed to the door when I heard keys in the lock. Jason wrapped his arms around me so tight that I felt a pinch beneath my ribs. I thought I heard him choke back a sob. When he finally let me go, he pressed his forehead lightly against mine and cupped the back of my head with his palm.
Don't worry, babe. Everything's gonna be okay.
I could tell he didn't quite believe it and was only saying it for my benefit. He knew all I ever wanted was a nice, quiet life together. 10. When I opened the door for Colin, 40 minutes later, he gave me a quick hug.
How are you holding up?
I shrugged.
Where is he?
Colin asked, his eyes moving up the staircase. Kitchen, eating ice cream. That was usually my nervous habit, not his.
How about little man?
I sent him to school this morning, thinking it would look bad to keep him home. Now I feel selfish.
You did the right thing. No use in him sitting around the house worrying about his parents.
In the kitchen, we found Jason at the breakfast table. He greeted Colin with a, hey, man, and an extended carton of peanut butter cup ice cream. Colin declined the offer.
A defense attorney named Olivia Randall is on her way over.
I had already Googled her. Based on the number of newspaper articles about her celebrity clients and high-profile trials, she seemed like a heavy hitter. Does it make Jason look guilty to hire a lawyer so fast, especially a big-name criminal defense lawyer? Jason apparently had the same concern.
It looks like I'm admitting I did something wrong.
Some girl's trying to destroy you, Jason, and you're sitting here with Haagen-Dazs like you're in a Kathy cartoon.
Ack, ack,
Jason said as he got up to put his ice cream away.
You're in denial, friend. This girl started a war with you. She needs to be swatted down like a bug. Olivia Randall will do it.
I had seen photographs of Olivia online. Dark hair, intense, pretty. Not entirely unlike Rachel Sutton. I pushed the thought away. What mattered was that she was a good lawyer, and that's what Jason needed right now.
She arrived 15 minutes later, dressed in a fitted black skirt and a bright green silk blouse. After quick introductions and professional handshakes, she skipped the chit-chat and went directly to business. "I'm sorry about this, Angela, but you can't stay." Jason immediately interrupted.
"I've already told Angela everything."
"It's not a matter of trust. To protect attorney-client privilege, Colin and I need to speak to Jason alone. And no, it doesn't matter that you're his wife. In fact, having Colin or me around while the two of you speak destroys the privilege each of you shares with the other." I already felt like the stupidest person in the room. I opened my mouth, but nothing came out. Colin placed a protective hand on my shoulder. "Angela's the one who found something online about this Rachel girl that might be helpful. Why don't we go over that first, and then the three of us can speak privately." I opened my laptop from the coffee table as we all got seated. Wilson Stewart's Facebook page was already pulled up. "This is one of Jason's other interns at his consulting practice. I found him by clicking on a recent photograph he was tagged in on Rachel's page." Olivia was leaning in for a closer look. The photo on Rachel's page was nothing special, the two of them and a female friend, strictly professional appearing. But on his page, I found this. I scrolled down to the photograph of him holding up a cocktail and getting kissed on the neck by someone who looked an awful lot like Rachel Sutton. He didn't tag her, so she may not even know that he posted it, but this was only 2 weeks ago, and supposedly she has a fiancé now. That's how this whole thing came up. Jason said something that offended her when she told him she was engaged. I saw something flicker behind Olivia's eyes, an idea. Something good, as if she were connecting my information to a fact only she knew. I had been worried that a female attorney might be offended at the thought of trashing the so-called victim, but she seemed pleased by my discovery. "Okay, that actually helps a lot. Now, I'm sorry, but I'll need you to leave us for a bit. I promise, Angela, I'm going to do everything I can for your husband." I felt like a child being sent away while the grown-ups talked. As I passed Jason, he mouthed a silent thank you and grabbed my hand for a quick kiss. His lips felt warm against my fingertips. 20 minutes later, I heard footsteps on the stairs. I opened the bedroom door to see Colin reach the landing. "Hey, I thought it would be Jason."
"They're still talking? I figured I'd come check on you. Crim law is foreign to me anyway."
"Am I being stupid?" He looked at me, clearly confused by my question. "Believing Jason. Am I being stupid? I mean, he says he made some sarcastic comment about her getting married too young, and she turns that into a sexual assault allegation? What am I missing?" I felt myself begin to shake. He stepped toward me, but stopped short of touching me.
"You're not stupid. Jason did not do this, okay? I think there's an explanation."
He glanced back downstairs. He didn't want to tell me too much.
Look, he said, lowering his voice.
Colin's close-cropped dark hair was beginning to gray, but he still had the same clean-cut, heart-shaped face that had led me to nickname him Boy Scout when we first met.
Olivia made some calls before she came over. She basically found out that there's no evidence except this girl's say-so, and what she told the police sounds worse than what she supposedly said to Zach right after the incident.
Well, that's good, right?
It's very good. But apparently the girl said something about being able to describe Jason's underwear with candy canes or something.
I held up a hand to my mouth. He said he was tucking in his shirt.
Wait, he said, trying to calm me. That picture you found of her sucking on that kid's neck might be a better explanation. Jason said there were urinals in the men's rooms at the econ department.
I was able to connect the other dots myself. The interns get drunk, Rachel and Wilson hook up. Wilson says something about spotting their hero's unexpected boxer shorts in the men's room. Rachel uses that fact to strengthen a flimsy accusation she made for God knows what reason. So is that what happened? Did Olivia call Wilson already?
We don't need him to say anything. Jason doesn't have to prove his innocence. They have to prove his guilt. This gives us an alternative explanation for what she claims to have seen in his office. It gives us a legitimate reason to make an issue of that picture you found.
A legitimate reason. But we all knew the real reason that photograph had been a good find. It made Rachel look like that kind of girl. I heard the staccato clicks of high heels on the hardwood of the first floor and then spotted Olivia Randall looking up at us. We're almost done, Angela. Sorry, again. Colin, you want to come down for a quick talk before I go? I returned to our bedroom and opened the top left drawer of our dresser.
A pair of crisp cotton boxer shorts adorned with bright red candy canes were folded neatly at the back, behind a uniform row of Jason's go-to black boxer briefs. The candy canes were a gag gift, something to fill space in his Christmas stocking. I remember the first time I saw him in them as he was climbing into bed. He said I was shaking both the mattress and his manliness with my laughter. I lifted them from the back of the drawer and placed them in the bottom of my gym bag. I would find a garbage can on the street tomorrow. 11. Corinne Duncan was making her fifth call to ADA Brian King since she'd seen the first story about Jason Powell that morning. Once again, no answer. King had declined the case almost immediately after Corinne submitted her reports. Corinne had hoped that he would deliver the news to Rachel himself, but apparently he hadn't. When Rachel called her yesterday looking for an update, Corinne had delivered the message. It was one person's word against another in a system where the government had to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It was a speech she had recited hundreds of times. Rachel's response still burned in her mind. "So is there no way to prove such a thing?" she asked, her voice jumping an octave. "Instead of pulling back, I should have waited until he raped me so I'd have scientific evidence." Corinne had to admit the woman had a point. In a world where DNA evidence could make or break a case, sex offenders could grab and grope and grind and gratify, as long as they didn't leave behind physical evidence. In theory, handfuls of people could have leaked the complaint against Jason Powell. Record clerks, her lieutenant, friends of Rachel. Rachel, of course. But Rachel had already called Corinne twice this morning, wondering how the Post had found out about her complaint. Corinne had another theory. It was the way she and Brian King had left their last conversation. After King concluded they didn't have anything close enough to evidence to take to trial, Corinne had suggestions for investigating further. King had rejected every one of them. "You'd be wasting your time," he insisted. "We know how this plays out. It's her word against his, with no way of meeting our burden. Not with her word alone." Not with her word alone. That was the phrase she remembered when she saw Jason Powell's name pop up on her phone's New York Post alert this morning. She tried King's number again, and this time he picked up. "King." Like he didn't know who was calling. "You could have given me a heads up," she said. There was silence on the other end of the line. She was used to this, ADAs who like to play boss over the police. There was something about Corinne, black, female, grown-up, straightforward, that threw them off their game.
"You're not mad at me, are you?"
2 days ago, you sounded perfectly willing to let the case go.
"I called a law school friend of mine who works in the career services office of NYU Law School. She asked around. No official complaints, but there are rumors."
"Of?"
"Something off. Maybe he's just the hot professor who students dream about, but some people get a bad vibe off him. A little too cute, a little too flirty, a guy on the prowl."
Corinne thought about King's initial comment about his ex-girlfriend's celebrity crush on Powell. "You, heard from anyone yet?" she asked.
"It's only been a few hours," he said.
She'd seen this before, when weak charges were filed against someone with the profile of a potential serial offender. King had let the police report leak in case any other women might want to come forward about incidents they had written off as misunderstandings.
"Any calls on your end?" King asked.
Thanks to an offshoot series of Law and Order, an increasing number of sex offense victims contacted the Special Victims Unit directly. "Nothing yet," she confirmed. "I guess I'd better call Rachel back. And no, I won't tell her it was you. I'll make sure she knows to stay in touch. It's possible that Powell will try to silence her." King didn't respond, and for a second, Corinne wondered if she'd lost the connection. "You there?"
"Yeah, I'm sorry. I got an email from Olivia Randall."
Corinne recognized the name of one of the biggest pain-in-the-ass defense lawyers in the city.
"She says she represents Jason Powell and has information I might be interested in." "That sounds fun."
"You're the one who wanted to stir up some trouble. Looks like you may have found the wrong kind."
"Whatever. Let me know if you hear from other women."
12. I was doing my monthly shuffle of the dry cleaning from wire hangers to real ones when Jason found me in the bedroom. "The lawyer's gone?" I asked. He nodded.
"I didn't want to explain who she was to Spencer.
He'd be home any minute." I had hung Jason's final shirt when I said, "Did you know that when you Google Jason Powell,
The fifth suggested search is Jason Powell wife.
That's normal. People get curious about author bios. They want to know if I'm married or not.
I shook my head and closed the closet door harder than I needed to.
I'm so sorry, Angela. I promise I'm not going to let you get dragged into this.
If only he had listened to me 4 years ago when he decided that he couldn't simply be a professor with a best-selling book. He had to extend the ride. And I had no choice but to go along. What if they find out? People will print anything these days. Maybe not the New York Times or the real papers, but one blogger, that's all it takes. I mean, the Post didn't print Rachel's name, but it's all over the internet anyway. It only took me a couple of minutes to find out she was cheating on her boyfriend with that other intern. Pretty soon, trolls will start looking for secrets about you and me.
Would that really be so bad?
Jason asked.
I know your parents had their reasons for protecting you, Angela, but it didn't have to be that way. You never had anything to be ashamed about.
I gathered up the wire hangers and left the room without saying a word. I'd given him my answer the last time we talked about this, and I wasn't going to change my mind now. It was 4 years since the last time Jason had encouraged me to come out of the closet.
It might help you to talk about it. Maybe go to a therapist, or go big and write that book Susanna offered to help you with. Or give her an interview. You could help other people, Angela, including yourself.
I was surprised he brought it up. At the time, I even wondered if he was thinking more of himself than me. Being known as the man who married that poor girl could only help book sales and his growing public image. I had made my answer, a resounding no, crystal clear. I didn't need help, and I certainly didn't need to help anyone else. I also can't change the world. Every time I read an article about a child missing or a woman abducted, I am reminded of all the reasons that my parents decided that it was better to protect my privacy when I came home than to tell the town that I hadn't run away. Admit it. When you hear about a missing kid or a murdered woman, you scour the article for clues. Not clues about the perpetrator, no. We search for clues about what makes that woman or child different from the women and children we know and love. Mom was having an affair. Kid was using meth. We need an explanation, something to reassure us that the horrible things that happened to them could never happen to us. In my own case, you wouldn't have had a hard time finding facts to comfort you. I started cutting class here and there in the ninth grade. My teachers and parents blamed my best friend, Trisha Faulkner, because it was easier that way. Various Faulkners were in and out of prison. They sold drugs, drove drunk, and picked fights in public over the slightest offense. Just like you feel better when you find out that the missing kid kept bad company, it was convenient to think that the Mullins' beloved daughter had changed because of the influence of a troubled girl from the most troublesome family on the East End. I wasn't an exceptionally bad girl. I got A's and B's in school, despite my occasional detentions. I was sent home twice for backtalking teachers, but had justifications that I stand by to this day for both outbursts. When I first got my learner's permit, I got stopped in my dad's car with beer in the trunk. The cop was nice and let me pour it all out, can by can, at the side of Old Stone Highway rather than call my parents. Any signs of rebellion were basically under the radar, until one summer night when Trisha and I were in the car with some guy from the city who crashed his BMW. Dad made it seem like I was some kind of hostage under the control of a cokehead who was only after one thing. The reality is that Trisha and I thought the guy was a joke. He bought us wine and let us blast music he had never heard of and told us stories about closing deals and making money. He was more like a drunk uncle for the night than any kind of predator. After my parents were called down to the police station, my father was determined to keep me from getting into any more trouble, and that's when things got really bad. Because here's the thing. The fact that adults made the BMW guy seem like the boogeyman made me believe there was no such thing as the boogeyman. It was the boy who cried wolf flipped on his head. Instead of a child sounding too many false alarms, it was my parents. Because that one guy had been harmless, I assumed the same of others who were happy to goof off on summer weekends with some local girls. And because my father prohibited me from hanging around with Trisha, she took on a new importance in my life. We became inseparable. If she cut class, I did too. If she rode the train into the city, I followed. But where Trisha was willing to run off for days at a time, that was a line I never crossed. Missing curfew by hours was one thing. Sleeping at a stranger's house because anyone was better than your own family was another. Ironically, The reason I was alone the night I was kidnapped was because I declined Trish's invitation to crash for a few days with a friend she'd made a few weeks earlier in Brooklyn. On a summer weekend, it wasn't hard to find something to do without her. I showed up at the beach with a joint and found a bonfire party to join. Usually I'd end up running into someone I knew, but not that night. They were all city people. I left once the sun was down and it was starting to get cold. As I was walking to the bus stop, a white Lexus SUV stopped and rolled down the passenger window.
Need a ride?
I'm good, I said. The 10B ran a loop all the way through Springs. It was practically door-to-door service.
You sure? Walking on the road in the dark's not exactly safe.
He had a point. Only a few weeks ago, a minivan had swerved to pass a turning car and run right into Corey Littleton on his bike. He was going to spend the entire summer with a cast on his leg. He offered another gentle nudge.
Plus, no bonfire.
He made a brrrr motion. It was the first of many clever things he did to work his way into my brain. To this day, I don't really know whether I actually recalled seeing him around the fire. But that comment sealed my impression that he had been there, too. I got into the car, and just like that, I was gone. I don't know why no one from that bonfire remembered seeing me. Maybe they had all left town by the time my mom started blanketing the South Fork with my photographs. Or maybe I just wasn't that memorable. But because my parents didn't know I'd been at the beach that night, they didn't know what time I went missing. All they could tell the police was that I was gone when they came home from work. It didn't help that when the police called Trisha's to see what she knew, her mom said she hadn't been home for 3 days. Once Trisha did return, she said she didn't think I'd run away without telling her, because that was the kind of thing Trisha would say. I didn't come home for another 3 years, and when I did, I had not only my reappearance, but 1-year-old Spencer to explain. My mother went from the woman searching for her missing daughter to the lady who told everyone it was none of their beeswax who Spencer's father was. The Mullins had made their decision. Better I be seen as yet another single teenage mom than as a freak show for life. As I had explained to Jason too many times, they were protecting my privacy, but they were also protecting me. I smoked pot, I was partying, I was bad. I got in the stranger's car, and then I stayed in that house with him for 3 years. If some intrepid blogger decided to out me, I knew how that story would read. I know it's only human nature to blame the victim. After all, wasn't I the woman who was helping my husband's lawyer paint Rachel Sutton as the kind of girl who would lie about her professor, even as a pair of Jason's boxer shorts was hiding in the bottom of my gym bag? I, of all people, knew I did not want to be the Rachel in the story. 13. When Jason's alarm pierced the silence at 5:30 the next morning, I wasn't sure whether I had ever managed to fall asleep. Every time I turned to face Jason, he was dozing peacefully, but I had no way of knowing whether it was from a lack of worry or the sleeping pill he took before turning off the light. He hit the snooze button, rolled onto his side, and pulled me into a tight spoon position.
"You're awake," he whispered. "Did you sleep at all?"
I think so. You getting up already? I assumed he would want to stay home under the circumstances.
I'm not letting some twit turn me into a recluse. Colin seems to think that lawyer will be able to shut this whole thing down fairly quickly. In the meantime, we have to go on with our lives.
Knowing his mind was made up, I told him that he was right. But unlike most days, he stayed in bed with me for 2 full snooze cycles. When the alarm sounded a third time, he kissed the back of my neck, told me he loved me, and made his way into the shower. I was on my iPad, Googling his name, when his phone let out a single staccato buzz on the nightstand. I never look, but that morning I did. It was his calendar reminding him of an appointment at noon. The event was entered simply as Carrie. He was buttoning his shirt cuffs when I pretended to wake up again.
"You're still home," I said with a sleepy smile.
"Oh, sorry for the noise."
"No, I like knowing you're here.
So, what do you have scheduled for today?"
"Oh, not much. I'm gonna make a point."